all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today a history professor that is working on a very interesting project that I think you're all going to go, I didn't know about that. Tim Westcott of welcome to Veterans Radio.
Welcome, James. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your current role. As I understand it, you're the director of the George S. Robb Center for the Study of the Great War at Park University in Missouri.
Yes.
Tell us about Park University.
Park University was established in 1875 by the Presbyterian Church, and then in 1975, we sort of broke religious affiliation with the Presbyterians. 67% of our over 16,200 students have some form of military connection. So either they are active duty, they're a veteran, or they're dependent of a veteran. We have 42 sites across the United States, primarily on Air Force bases, but we have campus centers, as we call them, on every branch of the service except Coast Guard. And then we have a major presence online thing. So very active, been around for 144 years. We've been actually educating military personnel for 101 years. We were one of the colleges that educated the Student Army Training Corps, or quote-unquote ROTC, cadets. And then we had a V-12 program in World War II. And we basically have been serving the military ever since.
Well, that explains a lot. Tell us something about the Center for the Study of the Great War.
The center was established in 2005 by the grandsons of George S. Robb. Robb was graduated from Park College at the time in 1912. He and his brother Bruce grew up in Assyria, Kansas, which is basically Salina, Kansas today, and they spent 4 years at the Park Academy, which at that time would be equivalent to a high school education, and then continued their next 4 years at the college. And then George goes to Columbia University in New York City, receives a master's degree, and graduates there in 1915. Comes back home, Kansas, goes into education, some public service, then serves in World War One. He is a white officer in charge of African-American troops in the 369th Infantry, or better known as the Harlem Hellfighters. And so his grandsons in 2005 decided to form the center, start the center, to study the Great War in very general purposes, but particularly the role of the enlisted men that served in all of the military branches.
That's a fascinating history on why the center came about, and it again explains a lot about why Park University and you in particular have been identified on this new effort. So let's talk about this new effort. There's a couple of legislators who in Congress who are seeking both houses of Congress to pass bills to authorize a review of the roughly 40,000 black troops who fought in combat during World War One, and whether or not any of them were denied wrongfully the Medal of Honor because of some intrinsic racism. So with that background, and this isn't the first time the military and Congress has done this, put some historical context around this for us.
I think for our listeners, you know, we have to be conscious of the time period in which we are looking at. You know, talking 100, 102 years ago, and our American perspectives, our cultural, societal perspectives have changed somewhat, hopefully to the better. But, you know, your viewers, listeners, excuse me, if you go back to the movie Glory and in the role of the 54th Mass in the Civil War, and we come forward a few decades, that sense of the function, the role, the type of service, particularly in which African Americans could serve the military, had not changed that much from the American Civil War, in how initially colored troops or CT units were looked at. So we were looking at, you know, we're not only looking at African Americans, we're looking at Asian Americans, we're looking at Hispanic Americans, Jewish Americans, and then Native Americans is our fifth group that we're looking at. What we're trying to determine, and there is documentation about 1925, 1926, that was conducted by the United States Army, looking at, in this particular report's case, the service of African Americans. And if you and I would read that report today, it would be shocking of how the United States Army personnel viewed the role and the function and the service of African American forces during World War One, which in some sense forms then our foundation stone or a cornerstone to why we believe an extensive systematic review needs to be done on all five groups that we're looking at. There was a quick looking at service records in 1919, but I mean, this was done in just about a month or a very short period of time, so there's been no real deep systematic review.
Looking internal at this issue for World War One follows on reviews that have been done for World War Two, and not only African Americans, but Jewish soldiers and Native American soldiers and Asian American soldiers. So you're building on some of that other work, I assume.
Yes, we are. The Shaw University in Rolla, North Carolina, contracted with the Department of Defense in the 1990s to do what really would be the first full-fledged systematic review regarding Medal of Honors. They focus specifically on African Americans of World War II. That was their entire focus. Subsequent to the Shaw, what we call it the Shaw University Report, is then groups like the Jewish American community in the United States put some pressure on DLG to review Jewish Americans. And that's where we come up with, you know, the only Jewish American from World War One that has received the Medal of Honor. And that somewhat drove the Stowers and the Johnson reviews, but those were done individually, not as a group. So if you think about, there's been only three Medal of Honors awarded, and that's been post-war, to two African Americans and one Jewish American. That's it. And let me give you a concrete example that really does hit home here. We've located in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., a 8.5 by 11 piece of white paper. On the top section of that paper, that archival record, is the Medal of Honor nomination, sort of the text of the recommendation, the nomination for George S. Robb. Our George S. Robb's, there's his nomination for the Medal of Honor. On the same piece of paper, at the bottom half, is the recommendation for a Medal of Honor for a gentleman by the name of William A. Butler out of Salisbury, Maryland. He's African American. He gets the DSC.
The Distinguished Service Cross.
Yeah, sorry. Distinguished Service Cross. And he received the Croix de Guerre with Palm from the French government, which is the equivalent to the United States Medal of Honor. Robb, on top, does receive the Medal of Honor, and we know that in his case, he's Caucasian.
Well, I don't think anybody would be surprised that, again, thinking about the period of time in which these were being looked at, shortly after the war, that sort of this inherent bias crept in and made impacted decisions on who should be recipients of the Medal of Honor. I'm sort of surprised that it's taken this long to get this work undergoing. And tell us if has Congress authorized this work? Has DOD supported your work at Park University when you're looking at these issues? How does this, you know, practically now work out?
There's Senate or S-1219. And H.R. 2249, maybe it's 1218, I'm sorry, S-1218, and H.R. 2249 are the House and Senate bills that is the actual legislation authorizing a couple of things. First of all, because we are beyond the statute of limitations on the criteria of the Medal of Honor, because it's over 100 years old, we're authorizing, or Congress has asked, we're authorizing to waive that statute of limitations on reviewing these individuals.
And that's not an unusual step, Veteran Radio listeners. We're talking to Professor Timothy Westcott from Park University, and you may have heard that same sort of comment before on current Medal of Honor recipients from the Vietnam era, who Congress has to waive this statute of limitations, if you will, period, so that these awards can be made. So this is not necessary. It's a necessary step, but it's not really an unprecedented or unusual step. I'm sorry, Tim, to jump in there, but I wanted to put some context around it.
No, James, that's perfectly fine. And the other thing, it does two things other than the statute of limitations. It requires that I have, you know, a DOD liaison that I work with quarterly to report progress, where we're at, and so on. And third of all, it requires no federal appropriations. We are not asking for any federal money to conduct this research for the project. So, three things, which is not unusual, you're right. The statute of limitations on the Medal of Honor, period of time. Second, it establishes the necessity for a liaison between my center and DOD. And then third, it requires no federal appropriations, either from the federal government in general or DOD.
And as you go through this, Tim, maybe it's with the DOD liaison, are there certain standards in which you're going to review? I think these are largely probably metal upgrades, right?
Yes.
Somebody has a lower level in metal and should have been put in line to be a recipient of the Medal of Honor. Are there standards in which you're doing those reviews and making recommendations?
Yes, we have to meet the current standards for a Medal of Honor. So we have on the task force a historian that has Medal of Honor sort of background, knowledge. His name is Dwight Mears. He just wrote a book on the Medal of Honor. And so we're working with him, and we have now created a template, probably the best way to say it. We've created a template that's the current standards. For example, under the current standards for a Medal of Honor in just that sense, so by meeting that criteria, we have to be able to provide the longitude, the latitude, the weather, and actual military mapping for the date and the time of the act of valor. So I have a young freshman. This is all, research is being all done by undergraduate students here at the university in our program of history. So I have a young freshman. That's his role. He finds the weather of September 28th, 1918 on the Meuse Argonne, whatever, at 10 o'clock in the morning, because we have to put that into the Medal of Honor template that would be then reviewed by the task force internally before we would even consider moving it up, which is a little bit different than it, right after the war, during the war's recommendations. And partly because, we have survivors, so we could go back and obtain that information. So it's made it interesting that we do have to go back that far to meet current standards for the nomination. So, yes, we have to do that as any act of valor would be described today.
And how many troops are you reviewing, or metal upgrades are you looking at here? What's the population size for this World War One look back?
We're probably estimating we will review 125 to 150 records for actual individual service members. Out of that number, again, we're estimating that the task force review committee that's internal to the center, they're the first group of experts, military historians, genealogists, whatever. They're the ones that will take the first major look at the nominations that we would think. So we're thinking maybe 30 to 36 of that 150 may probably get to this internal review. Out of that number, maybe a couple dozen would ultimately be pushed up through the Department of Defense chain of command for their review.
And then who ultimately is going to have the call here, Professor?
The secretaries of respective branches for which more likely will be, in our case, Secretary of the Army. But, you know, you could have the Secretary of the Navy, have a few in there between, you know, Naval and Marine Corps forces that we just haven't gotten to yet. But for the most part, the Secretary of the Army, just like the normal process, each branch has its own internal review standards and committees and stuff. That all has to go through the normal process. We do not make any recommendations. All we do is we'll forward what we call, you know, the packages of information.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get across to folks who might be listening and going,
yes,
are we changing, are we lowering, are we increasing the standards, are we applying the appropriate standards, the normal yes. standards, and the normal recommendation process on its way up to the president?
Yes, we are. Nothing's changing them from, you know, we're not changing the process in any way, form of the steps in which a Medal of Honor is awarded.
And what's, tell us a little bit about the size of the team that you have working on this project.
Well, the task force is composed of Dr. Dwight Mears, Dr. Jeff Sammons from New York University, Chris Elsby from the World War I Centennial Commission, Zach Austin from the World War I Centennial Commission, and myself. So that's, and Linda Dreyer from Salisbury, Maryland, is also on there. So the six of us actually on the task force, and then here at the center actually doing the physical genealogical forensics research, and like I say, the more of the military history component, and reaching out to descendants, which I primarily do initially. We have anywhere from 3 to 5 undergraduate students.
It's got to be very interesting work for them looking back at this, and certainly these are stories of valor, of incredible taking on the battle and the enemy to save lives of your comrades. So just the, you know, whether or not the package goes forward, just looking at this 125 or 150 troops that are being reviewed and their records are being reviewed is probably one heck of a history lesson for these undergraduates who are involved in that kind of basic research.
It's fascinating. And the profession of history, as you're quite aware, I mean, if you pick up any professional journal or even any major newspapers over the last, you know, couple of years, there's been articles on the demise of history and the low enrollment of history majors in colleges, and or the lack of any knowledge of history. And this project, in my opinion, emphasizes how history is literally done. I mean, this is what historians do day after day after day. And what we're able to do here with undergraduates is literally provide them what some historians may wait 25 years to do, because you are dealing with every human story. Every one of these service members, no matter how many we touch, that is a human narrative. That's a young man that went off to war, fought for this nation, may have died on the battlefield or came home. And when you start reading the personnel records and you read the horror stories that these young men had to deal with coming home, then we get a wonderful opportunity to hopefully talk to descendants. I mean, I talked to the daughter. She's 90 years old, but I talked to the daughter of the Jewish American that received the Medal of Honor in 2015. She lives here in Missouri. She was so proud of what we were doing, because it took her 15 years on her own time to finally get that medal awarded. You know, she kept emphasizing to me, you're not only doing it for the service member, but you're also doing it for the family.
Oh, absolutely, and for the larger community as well.
Right.
Let me ask: is your review only as to African American soldiers, or does it include those other groups that you mentioned—the Jewish, Native American, Asian American? You may have mentioned Hispanics. Yeah, there we go.
Our review is doing all five groups.
Okay. So that's a, you know, again, for those larger communities, and those are communities that have great pride in their service. The Native Americans have served this country's military with extraordinary valor and vigor, as have the Hispanic community. And I, you know, they don't get recognized maybe the way they should. And so this is really important work for that group as well, I would think.
Yes, I spoke to a researcher on the Native American side over the weekend. I love my job. I mean, I love teaching, I love research, but I'm also loving the opportunity to talk to some of these groups that have sort of been left out there on their own. You know, they're doing wonderful research. They're contacting the particular, in this case, First Nation, you know, archives, and particularly the elders of these First Nations. But they're sort of doing it as a small group, as a group on their own. And now that we can bring them all in under this bigger project, we hope, as with anything, you know, by mass, you know, we can get more done. And listening to some of the stories that they've been able to uncover and trace down, particularly, again, Native Americans, all five groups are wonderful. You know, listening to Hispanic American service, again, another group that sort of gets overlooked, and particularly Native Americans, because they, you know, they didn't become citizens until 1924. So, you know, they're not even quote-unquote citizens when they go off to fight and probably die for the United States of America. And, you know, 425,000 former service members from World War I, between the beginning of 1919 and the end of 1925, had already died. Think about that. 425,000 Americans that had served our nation were deceased by the end of 1925. Those stories need to be told, and we're doing that. We're doing that through our website. We're going to do that. If they go up to the internal review board, or even if they go up to DOD, we will tell 150 or 155 stories. We will make sure that all these stories are told in the digital age, so they can go, you know, be preserved. Future generations can read them for educational purposes, or the families can have those.
So, Professor Tim Westcott, before we run out of time, you mentioned the Harlem Hellfighters and its connection to George S. Robb. But for our veteran radio listeners, maybe the younger ones in particular, can you give us a little thumbnail about the Harlem Hellfighters?
Oh, boy. First of all, I would say there are some wonderful books on the Harlem Hellfighters. Jeff Sammons and John Morrow probably wrote the most definitive one. Recently, I would highly suggest that you look. There's some other great ones out there that would give you a really good review of them. They were the 15th New York National Guard initially. They, as their namesake would indicate, they were primarily a National Guard unit stationed in Harlem, New York. All African-American, and between the 369th of New York and the 370th out of Chicago, which is another wonderful infantry unit that, in my opinion, is also overlooked, is the valor that both of these regiments showed on the battlefield is just absolutely phenomenal. Not only by their officer corps, and again, most of these officers are going to be Caucasians, but the camaraderie the brotherhood. I mean, as a Marine, you know, there's a band of brothers, and you can see reading their letters and, you know, reading their documentation. It's somewhat hard to say sometimes, but they, you know, they broke down the race barrier by themselves by serving together.
And with such distinction. Again, this is that bit of history that gets lost. And I know it wasn't really our topic here, but you sort of touched on it. So I wanted to bring that in as we come to the conclusion of our time.
Yes.
And encourage our veteran radio listeners to do some of their own study and looking into the Harlem Hellfighters if they want to know some more about the acts of bravery and courage experienced, demonstrated by African-American troops in World War I. Tim, you mentioned you're going to put these things up on a website. So before we run out of time, tell us how people can continue to follow the work that's being done on this project and how they can read the stories in the future.
Let me approach that, James, in a couple of ways. We do have a Facebook page where we really post things pretty quickly, and that's just George S. Robb, R-O-B-B, Center, and it's C-E-N-T-R-E. We went the French spelling. Studies of the Great War. So like us, that's the easiest. Website is gsr.park.edu. There's no www in front of that. My contact information is on the contact page. And so if your listeners have family stories, you know, descendants, they think they may have something in their attic regarding great-grandfather, maybe a DSC recipient that meets the criteria of one of the five groups, please have them reach out to me or any other way that they desire, because we will definitely want to hear those stories, you know, from that point. And then the website will have the narratives. We're getting a couple of those ready to go now. So particularly if they like us on Facebook, we'll make announcements on there about a new narrative, or however you want to say that, is posted on the website.
Well, I want to thank you, Professor Westcott from Park University in Missouri. I think I'm trying to catch your pronunciation.
There you go.
on the project and the work that you're doing, reviewing whether or not World War I troops were not nominated for the Medal of Honor because of some inherent racism for all five minority groups. I think it's fascinating work. I think it's great that we're looking back at our own history and saying, hey, we can make some changes and get this right. So thank you for this information, and we're certainly going to be following along on how the project progresses over time.
James, I express my deepest appreciation for the opportunity to talk to your listeners. This is a 5 to 7 year project, so we'll be here for a while.
Thank you again. Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air. And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.